Welcome to the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. I'm Dr. Chris Tucker from the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center and the podcast founding editor. Today, we're discussing anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction with the addition of the lateral extra-articular tenodesis. I'm honored to be joined today by Dr. Alan Getgood from the Fowler Kennedy Sport Medicine Clinic in London, Canada, and the lead investigator of the Stability Study Group. Dr. Getgood was the senior author on the article titled Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction Plus Lateral Extra-Articular Tenodesis has a similar return to sport rate to anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction alone, but a lower failure rate, published in the February 2024 issue of the Arthroscopy Journal. Al, congrats on your work and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Chris. Pleasure to be on.
Al, it's pretty well known that the ACL is the most studied topic in all of sports medicine, potentially in all of orthopedics. Yet it seems like the paradox is the more we learn, the more we seem to realize how much more we have yet to understand. That being said, your work with the Stability Study Group is nothing short of monumental, and it's had a profound impact on many of our practices and certainly on our thought process about the pathology and treatment of ACL tears. Before we get into the specifics of this article, could you just give us some background on the history of the Stability Study Group to give us some perspective on the overall project and some context for this particular subgroup analysis and where it fits into the overall aims of your group?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I think the first thing just to, to point out is that it is a huge group. It's a large group of people, and I'm very, very fortunate to effectively quarterback that group. But without all of the people that are involved in in the multiple studies that we've performed over the years, then it wouldn't be possible. But everything really started probably in 2012. If you cast your mind back to then, there was that original paper regarding the anterolateral ligament by Stephen Klass. And that really sort of kickstarted the whole discussion around the anterolateral complex and whether or not you needed anterolateral ligament reconstruction. There were a number of centers in Europe at the time doing lateral extra-articular tenodesis, and of course that had been around for years. And that really struck my interest. And so when I started in practice, I started at Fowler Kennedy in 2012. So it was really kind of serendipitous that the start of my career, this area of interest came up, and I was very intrigued by it. We started with doing some pretty simple TOMIC studies with a master's student, Scott Catterin at the time, and then another master's student, Chris Hewison, who's actually interestingly just come back to doing a fellowship with us next year as part of his orthopedic program. But that was a systematic review that Chris did, and this was all in and around sort of trying to understand what was happening with the anterolateral complex. And round about that similar time, Isikos sent an application, request for proposals for applications for a multi-center, multi-continent clinical trials grant. And so with everything that sort of came about, we then came up with the idea of doing a randomized clinical trial looking at ACL reconstruction with or without tenodesis. And, that was the genesis of the Stability Study Group. And, really where it came from was, I had very lucky to have great mentorship from my senior partner, Bob Litchfield, and then multiple colleagues in Canada, likes of Pete McDonald, Nick Batati, Bob McCormick, Mark Hurd, Dave Bardana, people who were involved in research and had had research infrastructure in place, and with getting these guys together, and also Tim Spaulding and Peter Verdonk in Europe, we brought the group together, and they got behind this idea that we could do this trial for a relatively limited budget. I mean, this was small numbers that we're talking about, and really they did a huge amount of this work. Nearly from a charitable point of view, I'm sure you appreciate just how much money it often costs to run a large randomized clinical trial. But I got the backing of these very influential people, and we started the trial. We were told that we would never manage to recruit 600 patients into a randomized clinical trial, and without the dedication of all the team members, not just the consultants, not just the surgeons, but research assistants and many of the research directors within the different clinics, we were able to pull that off, and subsequently end up publishing in 2020 our primary outcome paper. So it was a long process. And then subsequent to that, we've then, with having collected a large amount of data, we've been able to then publish multiple papers from this large data set, which has really helped us try and understand a little bit more about really trying to control rotatory laxity and reduced graft failure in this at-risk population.
That's an interesting background, and appreciate you kind of bring us up to speed on how it all came about. I think you and all your coworkers are to be commended for, like you said, just the amount of diligence and kind of resilience that it requires to get a study of this size started, funded, and completed. So that all being said, before we discuss the findings of this study, could you just get us all on the same page and run through the technique for the lateral extra-articular tenodesis that you do just as it was performed for this cohort?
Yeah, I mean, we called it a modified Lemaire technique. The original Lemaire technique was a strip of the IT band that was then rooted underneath the fibular collateral ligament and then attached as posterior and proximal to the lateral epicondyle through a small bone tunnel. Now, our attachment point's a little bit more proximal to that, so more on the metaphyseal flare extending through the posterior cortex of the lateral femoral condyle, hence why we called it a modification of the Lemaire technique. You could also call it a modification of the McIntosh technique. I mean, they're all sort of one and the same thing. So for all the patients that were involved in the stability trial, it was a strip of the IT band underneath the FCL, reattached in the metaphyseal flare, and then fixed with a titanium staple.
Yeah. So for clarification, for your study, everybody in the stability trial got fixed with the staple, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Because I know there have been modifications to the modification, and I know fixation techniques have evolved. And I know there's a number of folks using, you know, suture anchors, suture staples, pull through technique with a tenodesis screw. But in your cohort, it was just primarily the staple, correct?
Yeah. And the likelihood is it probably doesn't matter that much. You know, we felt it was important that we did something that was relatively inexpensive, that if it did work and we wanted to expand that to, you know, centers all around the world. So you're really trying to improve the knowledge translation of the work that you're doing. And we felt it was more transferable into multiple healthcare systems.
So this study's stated purpose was to determine whether the addition of the LET to ACL reconstruction would improve the return to sport rates in young active patients who play these high-risk sports. So for those familiar with your award-winning paper reporting the initial findings of stability study group published in January 2020, like you said, you and your group are to be commended for the extremely strict inclusion criteria, which I think contributed to the validity of your findings. So with that in mind, before we get to the key findings for this publication, could you just outline for us just how this subgroup analysis defines both the young active patient and also the high-risk sport? Because I think those contribute significantly to your findings.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the most proud things I am of what we've been able to achieve with stability, you know, is really sort of changing the way we look at our patient population. I think up until stability, and maybe, you know, Moon also to a degree, because Moon really did a lot of subgroup analyses on their younger patient populations and very clearly showed, you know, as a predictor of re-injury that the young patient was at a higher risk. But up until that time, you know, the majority of studies that you look at, the mean age is maybe 27, 29. Most of the systematic reviews were up in the upper limits of upper border of the 20s. We wanted to focus on patients who were clearly at risk of re-injury. And that by doing so, we could then effectively increase our event rate and therefore was make it a more feasible trial to be able to get an adequately powered study. So, you know, when we're looking at young patients, well, I mean, we know the highest risk group is going to be the under 20 age group. Feasibility wise, just doing a study under the age of 20 is very tough, particularly with the numbers that we're talking about. So we felt that up to 25 was appropriate. That would be, consistently doing sport. So 25 was the upper age limit. And then when we sort of talk about high risk sports, well, it's really just looking at cutting and pivoting sports. And that we just sort of described as high risk. And what we're doing with this subsequent sort of analysis is really a deeper dive into that return to sport. You know, what things may be more predictive of a successful return to sport, whether or not knee stability or rehabilitation or different aspects of rehabilitation has an impact in getting your patients back to return to sport.
So with that in mind, could you just now go through for us the methodology for this study, you know, this subgroup analysis, and how you went about investigating the addition of the LET to the ACL, and outline for us your key findings from this paper?
Yeah, so I mean, it's the same patient population as the original stability study trial. So of the 618 patients that were randomized, we then wanted to look at those that had returned to high risk, or going from basically from a high risk to a high risk sport preoperatively to high risk, and then depending on the level of sport postoperatively. There were a number of, there's only a small number of patients that never actually were doing sport preoperatively and qualified for the study based on some of the other criteria, which were, you know, high Beighton score, high grade rotatory laxity, young age. So we just excluded those. And then there were a number of patients that didn't have any return to sport data at the 6, 12 and 24 month mark for one reason or another. So we excluded those. Only took out about 50 something patients. So we still were left with a large number of patients that had gone back to some form of high risk sport at a specific type of level. So at 24 months, we had 285 patients that had just the ACL alone and 268 patients that had ACL plus LET. And then we looked at a number of different outcomes associated with that. So if we look at our return to sport data, really it mirrors that what we showed in the original paper. We had about, you know, 87% return to sport across the whole group. If we just look at those that going back to a high risk sport, then it was about 76%. Not that surprising. You know, if you compare that to some of the systematic reviews that have been published, they've looked at maybe 63% has been shown in terms of a general return to sport rate following ACL reconstruction. Our population is a little bit more different in that one of the criteria for being part of the study in the first place was young age as well as being involved in sport. So it probably skews the information somewhat. And then if we look at then the re-rupture rates, now the re-rupture rates again also mirror that was, well, that was found in the original paper. The denominator is slightly different just because some of the patients were excluded of those ones that were at a low risk or were not involved in high risk to start with. But effectively, we got a 70% relative risk reduction in failure rates in those that are going back to sport with the addition of a lateral tenodesis. So really seeing very similar results than what we saw with the primary outcome paper. And then we tried to do a bit of a deeper dive in terms of some of the, you know, the predictors of return to sport, looking at strength, looking at some functional measures such as limb symmetry index of hop tests. So we didn't find hop tests to be very helpful at all. Most patients, like majority of patients, were up over 90% limb symmetry index at the 6 month mark before they were in back to sport. So we don't find that, you know, hop testing is very helpful. If you look at strength, we find that, you know, the stronger you were, there seemed to be a sort of a slight improvement, a general trend of being able to return to sport, but it wasn't really in any way isolated to any particular group. And then we looked at knee stability. And if you look at knee stability, we seemed to be a dose response. So effectively, the more stable your knee was, the more likely you were to get back to a high risk, high level of sport. Then you run into problems, right? If you start to try and break that down even further to understand if that's being driven by the LET or not the LET. And really then you get into sort of subgroup analyses, which then become underpowered and it becomes very messy. So, you know, I think, you know, there are a number of different things, some hypotheses that we stated in the discussion in the paper that, you know, may be going on. You know, I think patients that maybe haven't had an LED, then, you know, they might be able to get back to a better level of sport because they've improved strength, whereas the LET may help provide better stability and could also have an impact on strength gains postoperatively. But, you know, we just can't prove any of that within this particular study population.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I value in your papers is the discussion section certainly fairly eloquently describe the thought process about what you hypothesize might be happening in some of these patients and admit what you are powered to kind of state and what you're not necessarily powered to state, but where your findings are sort of trending. You know, I noted that comment you made about the stable knee having a nearly 2x greater odd of returning to high-risk sport. I think your odds ratio was 1.92. But, you know, chicken or the egg, what's coming first? And, you know, what's more important? Is it the, you know, is it the ACL and the LET, or is it the strength that's returning? I know you also mentioned, you know, the patients returning to their higher risk sports had better hamstring symmetry. And of note, all these ACLs were done with autograft hamstring tendons. So, you know, eliminating that with a different graft selection, I'm not sure what the impact would that have. Not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I think you're going to be addressing that in a follow-on study with different grafts being used instead of the hamstring. But I think one of the important notes I wanted to ask you about too was there was a comment in your results section where you had mentioned that in those patients who did return to high risk, high level sports, there was a 70% relative risk reduction in graft failure if they had the addition of the LET. So I know it's kind of a subgroup, but like you said, those who went back to a high risk sport, you know, those cutting pivoting sports, and they went back to the high level. So not just dropping down a level or two, but actually getting back to that competitive level at the highest of risk sports, they did have a fairly significant risk reduction in failing their ACL if they had the LET, as far as, you know, what's the patients for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to what we, when if you just look at the whole study as a whole, you know, it was a 66% relative risk reduction in graft failure with the addition of the LET. So we effectively know that your biggest risk of re-tearing your graft is if you go back to a high risk sport. And the more you do of that sport, then likely the greater exposure time, the greater risk that you're putting yourself in front of to be able to have a higher chance of failing. And if you're playing at a high level, the likelihood is that you're playing at that level more often than if you were playing at a low level. So, you know, it really comes down to exposure time. That's one of the massive challenges that we have when we try and really delve into return to sport rates. You know, there's one thing looking at a measure of just did patient A did go back to sport, but, you know, what level did they go back to? I mean, have they gone back at a level which is good? Are they going back at playing 45 minutes of a 90-minute game of soccer? Are they playing full games? And what's their level of performance? You know, there's so many other metrics around returning to sport that we very rarely capture in our ACL research. And I think it behooves us to try and improve on that and really try and understand it a little bit better. But effectively, the LET is protective of graft failure. And if you protect an athlete from having a re-rupture, they'll play sport longer. I think that's probably one of the main take home.
I think it's important at this point, if we could acknowledge the editorial commentary that accompanied your article. It was authored by Dr. Jason Grassbaugh, and he discussed the importance of critically examining these subgroup analyses just in general. He gave you and your entire group significant praise. Like I said, the dedication required to perform these randomized controlled trials of surgical procedures in large number of patients. But he also highlighted the caution that we need to have when interpreting these subgroup analyses when the secondary outcomes are reported. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on his comments on your subgroup size, the overlap with the original study, as well as your evaluation of the secondary measures, which differed from the primary outcome of your original study.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Jason brings up a very valid point, and, you know, we have to be very careful in terms of the interpretation of looking at secondary outcomes. But, you know, secondary outcomes are important. There are things that we can learn an awful lot, you know, particularly when you're going to the trouble and expense of trying to run such a large trial. You want to try and garner as much information as you possibly can so you can try and move the needle forward. But we have to be very, very careful in terms of how we interpret that. So yes, the original study outcome was clinical failure. You know, why did we choose clinical failure? Well, it was a composite outcome. And really the composite outcome, as actually Jason picked up on, was really just to try and increase the event rate. And with a higher event rate, then you can power your study a little bit better. And, you know, we guessed that based on this type of population, we would potentially have a 40% risk of having asymmetric pivot shift as well as graft rupture. And that actually was a very lucky guess because it was absolutely spot on. We saw a both statistically significant and clinically significant reduction in that clinical failure event, that primary outcome event. Now, if you then, part of that composite outcome is graft rupture. Graft rupture as surgeons is much, much easier to understand, you know, but then you can make the argument, well, you weren't powered to look at graft rupture. And so then we can come down and, well, you can look at your confidence intervals and you can look at your as a measure of precision. And then we have to understand that and really interpret that to determine whether or not change in graft rupture is clinically meaningful. And we actually tried to do this in a paper a little while back in the ACL study group was published in Knee Surgery, Sports Traumatology, Arthroscopy. You know, really trying to determine what is, as clinicians, we feel is an important change in failure rates. And if you look at our confidence intervals, I think the risk difference goes from 3 to 12%, to the upper limit being 12%, lower limit being 3%. And is that enough to change practice? And so again, we felt that this was both clinically and statistically significant change in our graft rupture rates. And so, and you know, our findings are effectively mirroring what we saw within this new sub-analysis looking at, you know, at our patients that are going back to sport. And so we're not really trying to say anything different. It's really just a matter of really trying to tease out, you know, of the patients that went back to sport, were there any factors that would maybe push them back to sport versus not? And as you said, you know, within our discussion, there are lots of factors that, that have been brought out, particularly, you know, in regards to patients that have, you know, kinesiophobia or just don't have, you know, confidence in going back to sport is one of the major reasons patients didn't go back to sport.
I think following that same train of thought, there's many reasons athletes may not get back to their sport, with knee stability only playing a part. You talked about this in your paper, and I think you and your co-authors are to be commended for trying to dive into that psychology of returning to play through your surveys. And in your cohort, the most cited reason for not returning to sports was a lack of confidence and or fear of re-injury, like you had mentioned, that kinesiophobia. So this seems to me to be a fairly understudied area of ACL surgery, but it's gaining some traction lately. What are your thoughts on that psychological component of returning to activity in general, sports after ACL surgery, as in your study? And what do you think we need to be doing to improve that aspect of care for our athlete patients?
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, it's a huge area that really, there's a number of groups working on it. You know, Kate Webster, Julian Feller should be commended, you know, developed the ACL RSI score. Of course, there are, you know, multiple groups across the world that are really trying to understand this a little bit better. We've, so myself, colleague Diane Bryant, who's a co-PI on stability and as well as stability too, I've been very fortunate to be co-supervising a physical therapy PhD student, Hannah Marmura. And Hannah has been very prolific in, over the last number of years and doing a lot of this type of work. And she's been performing a qualitative study looking at patients and interviewing patients, many of whom were part of stability, some were part of stability too, and really trying to understand some of the psychological aspects about how they deal with their post-injury experience, but also pre-reconstruction and then post-reconstruction, so it's around about baseline and a year post-op. And there are certainly, there are characteristic personality traits that go along with their coping strategies. And there'll certainly be a number of athletes who from the get-go are very much focused on sport, and it's, for them, it's probably not going to be as big an issue. There will be other athletes where sport is maybe not as big a focus, and you know, it's not as big a part of their life, and they have other, there are other things going on that they can, you know, get an awful lot of attention from, whether it's their schoolwork, their occupation, their family, and you know, and that then helps them create some coping mechanism around about their injury pattern. I think as clinicians, we probably will need to get to the stage where we need to be a little bit more clued up as to the individual sitting in front of us. Which maybe goes back to what I said at the very, very start when we, you know, we're breaking down these patients into, it's becoming much more individualized. You know, ACL surgery is not just about one size fits all. It's becoming individualized surgery, but also individualized rehabilitation and gearing up their rehab and understanding their needs going forward. And I think it's going to take a much greater multidisciplinary approach than what maybe you and I can do just as surgeons and, you know, putting a graft to, from point A to point B.
We touched on this earlier, but I just wanted to hear your thoughts because you do have the benefit of observing such a large cohort of people with such detailed clinical analyses. But all these patients had their ACLs reconstructed with autograft hamstring. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on any implications that may have in light of the other graft options being used for ACL surgery in young athletes. And then if you've observed or think of any gender effect as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we didn't really see any sort of sex-based difference within stability, but there's no question that's something that we need to be investigating further. You know, the graft question is always going to be something that, that needs to be addressed. And, you know, there are not just our study, but there are multiple other studies. Nick Matati's study was, you know, important, and some of the work by the Dante study group as well, showing that isolated hamstring grafts, you know, the addition or the failure rates with an isolated hamstring graft in a young age population going back to high risk sport, the failure rates are higher generally than maybe an extensor mechanism graft. You know, I think what stability adds to the mix is that, you know, if you are treating patients that are under the age of 25 going back to contact pivoting sports, then you probably shouldn't be doing an isolated hamstring graft in that patient population. And that's also being shown in New Zealand registry. There's multiple sources of information that's really highlighting that. Now, that doesn't mean to say that hamstring graft's a bad graft. It's just not the best option in that specific patient population. Now, the big question of then, well, can you mitigate risk by using maybe an extensor mechanism graft, either a BTB or a quad graft? Well, that's the focus of our study in Stability 2. So we're about 840 patients randomized into Stability 2 now. So that's now a 30-center randomized clinical trial. It's NIH-supported, CIHR-supported. We've been going now nearly for 5 years in recruitment. We hope to finish recruitment by the end of this year. It'll be 1,236 patients. So that's quad tendon versus patella tendon with or without the addition of tenodesis, with the ultimate goal of amalgamating all the data from Stability 1 and Stability 2. So we'll have three grafts, all with or without tenodesis under the age of 25. And I think that should allow us to tease out, you know, these differences in grafts and whether or not graft truly does make a difference or not. So at this stage, I have no idea, but complete equipoise. So we'll have to wait and see what that data shows. But, you know, I think where I don't have equipoise anymore would be to, you know, randomize a patient to a hamstring graft on its own, because I think the data is really pretty much overwhelming from that point of view that we shouldn't be doing that in the young age population.
Yeah, I know there's many of us anxiously awaiting Stability 2 results, yourself included, I'm sure. As we've said, the ACL is the most studied topic in all of orthopedics, and there's a lot of continued advancement in the field, as with papers such as yours. That being said, what do you think is currently the most exciting area of research needing to be done? What do you see as the most important unanswered question in the area of ACL research right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. The first thing I would think about is prevention. And it's not really much a question that needs to be answered. I think the question has been answered regarding prevention, but that's more implementation science. We know that prevention works, and really we should be doing an awful lot more implementing prevention programs, across the, high schools and universities and various other organizations. So I think that's something that's very, very important and will have a dramatic impact on the number of patients that we're seeing. Other than that, you know, I'm very hopeful, fingers crossed, that Stability 2 will help us answer the question regarding graft choice and lateral tenodesis. It'd be nice if we could park that question once and for all, but I'm sure we won't be able to. Someone will come up with another ramification of that question. But, you know, I think really going forward, it's going to be post-traumatic OA. You know, that still is the critical piece here. You know, yes, it'd be great if we can reduce graft rupture rates. If we can get patients back to sport. But, you know, there's still an injurious event. There's still a very unphysiologic intervention that we as surgeons perform. And, you know, we can't get away from the fact that, unfortunately, many of our patients do develop post-traumatic OA at a younger age. And we really need to be putting a lot more focus on that to see if we can try and reduce that risk.
Yeah, I think those are fantastic questions to be at least investigated and looked at, you know, the potential for biologics, the potential for, you know, post-operative rehab protocols to potentially alter some of that PTOA. Hard to know, but agreed. That's kind of the inevitable, that none of us can undo the initial injury, despite, you know, the best surgical technique, we can't undo that original injury. So Al, you provided us a really nice summary of the inclusion of the lateral extra-articular tenodesis in conjunction with the ACL reconstruction and its implications for returning to sport and re-rupture rates in these young active patients. Did you have any other closing remarks before we wrap up our episode?
No, I mean, I think lastly, thank our Arthroscopy Journal for, you know, for publishing our work. And it's important that this sort of information gets out there, and it's a great opportunity for us to be able to discuss it further and really highlight a lot of the work that Stability Group and my co-authors have really contributed to this space. So thank you very much.
Hey, you're welcome. Thanks for being here. Dr. Getgood's article titled Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction Plus Lateral Extra-Articular Tenodesis has a similar return to sport rate to anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction alone, but a lower failure rate, is published in the February 2024 issue of the Arthroscopy Journal, which is available online at www.arthroscopyjournal.org. This concludes this edition of the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next time.